hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Call our last argument for the September calendar, 04A P630-CR, State v. Forrest Schomburg. Thank you all for coming today, and we hope you feel better, counsel. We have Charles Giesen, Attorney Giesen, representing the defendant, Forrest Schomburg. Thank you for your courtesy to Mr. Schomburg and allowing that. I'm sorry, Mr. Giesen. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Charles Giesen. I'm representing Forrest Schomburg, who was convicted in the sexual assault of a woman who was grabbed and groped in a parking lot off of State Street and sentenced to 12 years in prison. Mr. Schomburg was convicted of this offense in spite of the fact that the victim did not identify him at the trial or at the preliminary hearing as the perpetrator, and in spite of the fact that his physical appearance does not match that that she gave to the police the night of the incident of a 20 to 30-year-old assailant with blue eyes who was 5 feet 10 inches tall. Mr. Schomburg's conviction, we submit, should be reversed on two grounds. The first is that he was denied his constitutional right to present a defense by the erroneous ruling of the trial court excluding an expert witness on eyewitness identification procedures and science. And secondly, this conviction should be reversed under Section 751.06 because the real controversy, the identification of the perpetrator, was not fully tried. Eyewitness identification has been described as being notably convincing and also as notably fallible. This fallibility has been well documented in recent years and is really not the subject of any serious debate. This court recognized...
Okay. I want to just ask a question. This case was tried before a judge, not a jury. So it was Judge Pat Fiedler. Judge Fiedler seemed to be concerned, and I thought, very interested and might have admitted the foundational, your expert's foundational, as to why sequential may be better or worse than another type of lineup. The problem I have is with the second part, where your expert wanted to testify that as to what happened in this case. In other words, why they could not make a proper identification, why one was not made by the victim and the security guard. Would you just address that? Why you think, because I think that there may be some room to discuss the foundational part, allowing an expert to come in and say why eyewitness testimony may have some trouble. But it's when you talk about this case and why those people could not identify your client.
With respect to the foundational issue under 90702, we believe that was fully satisfied with respect to the ability to present an expert witness. There is no serious question as to this witness's qualifications. The State has raised none in its brief. The second prong under 90702 with respect to the foundation for an expert is that it must bear on a relevant issue. Certainly, nothing was more relevant to this case than the eyewitness identification of the perpetrator or the validity of that identification. Lastly, with respect to the foundational element of whether or not this would have assisted the trier of fact, we feel the record is clear. Judge Fiedler acknowledged that he was not familiar with the merits of a sequential as opposed to a simultaneous lineup. In fact, in rendering his verdict, he even stated that he didn't know that one was better than the other. The reason he, as finder of fact, did not know that is that the defendant was precluded from having presented evidence on that issue. And it's our view that when a jury is making a determination based on any science, be it DNA, fingerprints, eyewitness identification, they should be entitled to have information about the scientific underpinnings of whichever aspect they're considering.
Attorney Gieson, I think what Justice Wilcox was asking you was not about that part of the testimony. It seemed to me you argued two prongs of error for not letting the expert testify. One, in regard to the sort of background information about why sequential presentations tended to produce more reliable results. The second part, and the part I think he was asking you to speak to, was why was it error to prevent the expert from testifying to that second element, that these people likely made a misidentification because, which really goes to, as the trial court concluded, whether these witnesses' credibility could be impeached by this witness. I think that's what he wants you to talk about, and I'd like to hear that, too.
Okay, thank you. That is really not a basis of this appeal. We are not claiming that the expert should have been permitted to give an opinion on the ultimate question.
You are not arguing 90704?
That has not been raised. We are not. What we're saying is Mr. Schomburg was denied the opportunity to present a defense that would have undermined the reliability. It's not an issue. I think that was dealt with in the Hampton decision, where the jury had the fundamental scientific background, was aware of the fallibilities, the flaws that were present, and the court in that case ruled it's for them to apply that science to the facts as presented.
I'll present it differently. Did the expert testify? Was the expert allowed to testify as to anything?
Absolutely nothing.
Didn't testify at all. And that's your objection. So that if there was valid objection to parts of the expert's testimony, that you may or may not win on that, but that really isn't the issue because none of the testimony here was admitted.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Yes, we never got to that point because the expert didn't take the stand.
Right.
Mr. Gieson, in your appendix 19, there's the report from Paul Carroll, and that report was received, I think. It wasn't in evidence, but it was before the court. What do we make of that?
Well, I note that that's one of the grounds that the state asserts renders this harmless error, but as the judge noted in rendering his verdict, he had to decide the case on the trial record. That was not a part of the trial record. Typically, an expert provides a synopsis or overview of their proposed testimony, but that never made it into the trial record. So that was not a basis of Judge Fiedler's decision, as he noted.
And the judge should not have taken it into consideration, I gather, or maybe he should have, if he excluded it.
If
it was a jury, they would have said strike it.
That's right, and the jury would have been instructed to disregard it, and Judge Fiedler himself said he was bound by the record and he was not considering that because it was not admitted into evidence.
So your issue is if you don't allow an expert testimony about the validity of eyewitness identification, if you don't allow none of it in, that is a violation of presenting a defense?
In a case where eyewitness identification is the only issue and where there are flaws in the identification procedure, it's our view that is an infringement of a defendant's right to present a defense.
Why wasn't, if it's error, why wasn't it cured by the cross-examination of the witnesses, the eyewitnesses?
Because
they had very little opportunity to observe the assailant, and that these identifications didn't match what the original description was. I mean, there was lots of ways of attacking it on cross-examination, and there was good cross-examination here, wasn't there?
There was, but it was only referenced in passing, and it was cross-examination, well, of a police officer. For example, there are many aspects that are common sense and for which an expert is not necessary. We all know that you can't identify someone as well in the dark as you can on a bright day. However, most attorneys, judges, lay people, and the judge in this case, are unaware of some of the scientific underpinnings that undermine identifications in this situation, such as the concept of relative judgment. Judge Fiedler himself acknowledged in rendering the verdict, he didn't know that a simultaneous lineup was any different from a sequential lineup. And that is an important fact. That's one of the aspects of identification that was not fully tried. In fact, since this appeal was filed, the Attorney General's office itself, in recognition of the deficiencies in eyewitness procedures, has adopted a model policy and procedure in order for us to have what they describe as the most reliable method of obtaining identification evidence. And that model policy, adopted by the Attorney General's office, requires that or suggests that lineups be conducted in a double-blind fashion, that they be conducted sequentially, and that the fillers be selected so as to minimize suggestiveness. None of those procedures were complied with in this case, and the finder of fact was not aware of the consequences or the impact that this could have, the astonishingly high error rate that these types of identifications lead to, which have been shown to be as high as 80 or 85% of all wrongful convictions having resulted from erroneous, mistaken eyewitness identifications.
And your offer to proof, was that what this witness would have testified to?
Yes. He would have testified as to the concepts of relative judgment, as to the deficiencies of simultaneous lineups contrasted with sequential lineups, and the necessity for having fillers that did not create or lead to a relative judgment problem.
Mr. Giesen, if you win this case in a way in which by virtue of the court ruling that this testimony should have come in, how do you think the state is going to respond? What I mean by that is this. Is the state, if they change their procedures, if they have sequential lineups, if they have the other changes in procedure that are recommended, is the state going to be able to bring in expert testimony to talk about the quality of the identification?
I assume that they would be able to, and hopefully there would be adequate evidence before the court to fully try that issue. Because in this case, the prosecutor argued time and time again in his closing that this was an adequate lineup, that this was a sufficient and non-suggestive lineup. And there was no evidence in the record to support that. So, I would be speculating as to what the state would do, but I suspect that the science is there, and they would very well have at their disposal someone who could present their point of view.
Well, to push that point, then what are you going to do in these criminal cases where eyewitness identification? I don't know what percent of criminal cases is eyewitness identification. Maybe the you do or the state does. Are you then going to have a battle of experts? I think that's the next question.
Well,
it's identification, and everybody's going to forget what the crime is and just think about the experts.
I think it will enhance the overall reliability of verdicts if juries are better informed. It goes back to the defendant having a constitutional right to be able to present a defense, and if that does implicate, in some cases it implicates expert testimony, sometimes not. It will certainly lead to improved procedures, and I note that in this past week, Assembly Bill 648 was passed, which implements some of the Avery Commission's findings. And just this week, the Milwaukee Police Department has adopted procedures that would require sequential lineups, double-blind lineups, and non-suggestive fillers. So hopefully the ultimate result, in a larger sense, will be there will be fewer innocent people convicted, and juries will be able to make better decisions with more information.
Okay, if we adopt the sequential lineup and juries are better informed, does that take care of the battle of experts? In other words, is that going to go on anyway?
Well, if the police conduct these procedures in the best available fashion, then there really is not a necessity. Or opportunity, for that matter, to attack the procedure. If the procedure is done in accordance with what science recognizes is the best, least suggestive, least mistake-prone method, it doesn't seem there would be a need for it.
Isn't the expert going to come in and say, regardless of any method, the eyewitness identification is not the best, and this is why, no matter what method is used?
Well, our system is an imperfect system. Trials, the search for truth, always leave some questions, but what we're asking this court to do is recognize the defendant's fundamental right to present a defense.
Mr. Giesen, I want to focus on, or at least look at, how far this decision may impact in other types of cases. Now, you've only argued that it should apply where you have an eyewitness identification, which is the sole evidence in the case. What about a situation, because this opinion may be applied to other situations, where you have additional evidence besides the eyewitness identification, but the eyewitness identification is arguably critical to the conviction? What would your position be regarding that situation?
In some circumstances, there could be a typical harmless error analysis if there's a wealth of other corroborating evidence, but that's
after you find that there's errors. It's still would it be your position that there would still be a denial of the right to present a defense? That's what I'm trying to focus on.
Yes. In our view, be it DNA proof, be it serology proof, be it blood alcohol proof, a defendant is always entitled under the Constitution to present evidence challenging that proof.
Counselor, don't you get into the problem of taking away the trial court's discretion to keep from having many trials within criminal trials? I think that's what's kind of bothering the court a little bit about where are we taking ourselves if we buy your argument. I mean, we can have four experts on many different facets of eyewitness identification, or just pick some other item that's necessary for the state to put in its case and is prejudicial to the defendant. And I think, you know, when you go back and look at Hampton, it was decided on the basis of a discretionary ruling by the trial court. When you look at St. George, it's decided on the basis of a constitutional right to present a defense. And where do we let the trial court draw the line so we don't have a bunch of mini trials going on?
Well, the trial court would obviously retain discretion under 90702 with respect to experts. The particular problem in this case is that this would not have been a mini-trial. It was decided in pretrial motion hearings, and we submit it was error as a matter of law because neither the trial court nor the court of appeals considered the constitutional law principles or the impact those would have on their exclusion, on the exclusion of the evidence that was proffered by the defendant.
You can say that about any evidence. If it's necessary, if you can fulfill the standards of St. George and you can show it is necessary to the defendant's defense as well as the other three of the four-part tests that you have, you can say that about any evidence the defendant wants to present.
Sure. 20 years ago, excuse me for interrupting.
No, that's...
I was thinking 20 years ago when I was a trial judge, there was a cottage industry begun over the Intoxilaser 5000. And there was I don't want to disparage any of the experts, but there was an expert in Wisconsin, or maybe two of them.
Whose name started with G.
No, I'm not going to say, but he would always come in, and he would challenge the scientific reliability of the breathalyzer, as I recall. And he or she was always there to explain this in magnificent depth, but ununderstandable to both the jury and the judge, but it was always there. And eventually, the courts didn't allow that evidence, but I remember in the beginning that was always a battle of experts. I don't remember the name, maybe.
I do. See?
Well, I think the person was from your area. That's all I'm going to say. In any event, what do we do with that? Because if we allow this, quote, battle of experts, which it looks like that's what it's going to end up being.
Well, we're not advocating that judicial discretion be abdicated. And if the St. George standards are applied, there should not be that problem. The expert testimony has to be, under St. George, necessary to the defendant's case. Here it clearly was. This was the only issue at trial.
Counsel, wasn't there another issue? Didn't he have an alibi defense? And wasn't that alibi defense found to be incredible by the trial court because of a letter he wrote on about April 10th to the people who then testified that he was with them at the time of the assault?
There were other issues, but that was secondary in our view to the identification issue because you don't even need to get to that point if there's a reasonable doubt as to the identification.
Well, but doesn't the fact that he wrote to these people bear upon the trial courts deciding whether or not to believe that he was with these people? Well, you know, I mean, don't you think it's possible that letter could imply guilt on his behalf?
That's a possibility, but that letter would have to be put in the context. It was intended an effort to locate witnesses. And if I may, I would request to reserve the balance of my time.
You don't have to. You get 5 minutes anyway, Mr. Giesen.
Oh, okay.
You've got about 3 minutes left, but now that you've interrupted yourself, I'm going to ask you a question. The Wisconsin Innocence Project of the Frank Remington Center at the law school here put in an amicus brief on the general issue of eyewitness testimony identification. Their position is that expert testimony on eyewitness identification should be excluded, should be presumptively admitted, unless the court would find that the expert's really testifying as to what lay jurors would know. I mean, I think that is an accurate portrayal of their position. Is that your position? It wouldn't be, but I would like to know what your position is.
Right. We didn't advance that in our brief, but on reflection, we think that is a very good idea for several reasons. First of all, under the system as it exists, there is an unacceptably high number of innocent persons being convicted based on mistaken eyewitness identification. As laudable as the proposed reforms in Assembly Bill 648 and the Attorney General's model policy may be, there's certainly a step in the right direction. None of those are mandatory, nor do they create any substantive rights. If identifications are enhanced, everyone wins. The police win, the victim wins, the public wins. Certainly the wrongfully accused persons are winners. And as the AG policy points out, eyewitnesses can be mistaken. They're honestly mistaken. They appear sincere. And the only way to help minimize those mistakes is to permit expert testimony. So based on those reasons, we would...
I know. Could you check the effect? Yes.
Is this gone again? My time?
Right, the case is over. Are we checking to see if this is just,
I don't think it's...
This is the text of the alarm. It was. They are not evacuated. The old part of periodic fire. So they all sit quietly. Thank you. I've lost it.
That's right. Thank you. Okay, counsel, we'll decide it.
We'll go charge. Decided we got a call. We get the truth.
We do.
On behalf of whoever is in charge, I apologize for this delay. We were told that we need not evacuate.
Although
so
everybody
we did
else.
Not, but some people did not get the word. It sounds as if there was some defect in the
cut the wires.
And off. Okay. All right. Okay. Do we have everybody?
See. The marshal went to get the other two people. Two. So
right.
We have to wait just a Jeff or the assistant marshal.
You should all be aware that the alarms do work. They work in the far recesses of the building, including all of our chambers, which I think is good. It didn't before the remodeling here. And then we do have periodic drills, and all of us do leave the building at that time. So we're now waiting for two colleagues to rejoin us, and then we will proceed. You had your orange light on, but don't start it again, please. And I think, Mr. Giesen, you were answering a question about the rule of law that is proposed by the Wisconsin Innocence Project and a presumption. That's where we left off. Thank you. Mr. Giesen?
Thank you. Yes, with respect to the amicus recommendations, for the reasons I was stating, we believe that those are a good idea. They are consistent with the dissent's recommendations in the DeBose case that eyewitness identification procedures be improved and that the problems could be exposed or dealt with by a more complete presentation of eyewitness identification experts. So those are consistent.
Well, those recommendations, is the position of the Innocence Project consistent with the St. George criteria?
I'm sorry, with the?
The position of the Innocence Project, is that consistent with the St. George criteria?
It certainly would be. We're not advocating.
I'm going to go farther because if I understand their position, they're calling for a presumption versus an analysis that would go through and determine its relevance, whether or not 90702 applies. You see the difference?
Correct. It would be a presumption of admissibility, but obviously there would still be limitations and strictures on it, and it may well be along the lines of the St. George requirements. Obviously, an expert would still have to be qualified under 90702. It wouldn't just abandon all restrictions or limitations on calling an expert, but would provide a framework and a presumption that it would be presumably admissible.
Mr. Giesen, how could you possibly overcome the presumption if we took that route?
Well, in this case, we could because it satisfies. If we took the routes presuming it admissible,
right.
Well, for instance, it could be cumulative. The expert may not be adequately qualified. It may be an expert proffered on an issue that's not directly relevant. The court would still have to weigh many of the traditional considerations, and there wouldn't be complete license to call any expert on any subject at any time.
I have another question. I think the trial court here relied on the Hampton case, if I have it right.
Hampton. Yes.
In Hampton, there was a concurrence on the Telfer affair instruction, which is an instruction to a jury saying, watch out about eyewitness identification, etc. What's your position on the Telfer instruction, and is it given in Wisconsin? And should it be?
It is, and under both Telfair and 141, we submit the real controversy was not fully tried because the Telfair instruction states that if the identification may have been influenced by circumstances under which the identification was made, the jury should scrutinize that identification with great care. So while ostensibly deciding under 141 in Telfair, the finder of fact in this case was not equipped to know that the identification was in fact influenced by concepts of relative judgment, suggestiveness, and so forth, and wasn't able to fully determine the issue in accordance with the law.
But isn't that a comment on the credibility of the witnesses if you get that far along the continuum?
No, because the challenge is not to the credibility of a witness. An eyewitness may have an honest belief they're making a correct identification. Rather, it is to the reliability of that identification itself.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Giesen. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney Christopher Wren, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Wren.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Christopher Wren. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I appear on behalf of Plaintiff Respondent, State of Wisconsin. I'd like to say what I think this case is about, and I think it's consistent with a number of the questions that the Court has asked during the first half hour, 45 minutes, interrupted. In the State's view, this case is about three things, one of them which takes direct issue with one of Mr. Giesen's arguments. The first thing that this is about the narrow issue of the appropriate exercise of judicial discretion in excluding testimony of an expert witness. It has nothing to do with attempting to suppress identifications or anything like that. It doesn't implicate DuBose, as the supplemental letter might suggest that Mr. Giesen sent earlier. Second, this is about the exclusion of expert testimony because of an incomplete offer of proof. The State's position is that there was not an adequate foundation made in this case. It wasn't necessarily it wasn't necessarily the attorney's fault that he didn't make an adequate foundation. I think it's a problem of a new area of law where the offer was not made by presenting the expert himself, but through the offer of the attorney's representation about what would happen. The third thing.
But then he memento with the attorney's representation. Suppose the expert had testified as to what the attorney said. I know that the offer of proof is generally to be made by the
attorney. I think the case is kind of captured here in an exchange that occurs in the transcript itself on pages 23 and 24. This is where Mr. Cohen, the defense counsel, has explained what he wants the attorney to talk, what he wants the expert to talk about, what the expert will testify about. And Judge Fiedler says, for the first time on page 23, so what we're back to is, and then he says, recites it in the context of things that an expert would not necessarily talk about. And then Attorney Cohen responds and said, and tries to explain it again, and Judge Fiedler's response is, again, so what we're back to is, what we have is a situation where the offer of proof was made, in a sense, the way I would characterize it is that Attorney Cohen understood, you know, the buzzwords, the buzz concepts related to this eyewitness identification, simultaneous lineups. But when the judge had questions, when Judge Fiedler had questions, asking the so what question, in effect, when he wanted to know how does this differ from the kinds of things we don't want expert testimony for, that's where Attorney Cohen was not able to make the link that an expert testifying would have. I think if the expert had been there for a Q&A kind of offer of proof, the expert would have understood what Judge Fiedler's confusion was, what his concerns were, and would have been able to address that. Unfortunately, I think Attorney Cohen was not able to address that. That's why foundationally, I think this was not an adequate offer of proof, and that Judge Fiedler's decision, as an exercise of discretion, was to say, I don't see how this differs. You haven't explained to me adequately how this differs from what's going on when we just have somebody come in and do cross-examination or make an argument or make oral argument. And I think part of the reason, I think it's important to understand when this was occurring. There's a certain history and context in which this particular lineup and this particular motion was brought. I think important, this lineup occurred on April 4th, 2002. At that time, only one state, the state of New Jersey, had adopted the sequential lineup. I first became aware of it through a New York Times article in April of 2001, which I forwarded on to our training and standards people, and I believe that they started working on some things like that at that time. But that was only 6 months before this lineup occurred. At that time, according to this record, Attorney Cohen had not attended any training on it, and Detective Marion Morgan, who was the person who was familiar with the lineup procedure, had not attended it either. Mr. Cohen said that he attended this seminar that Mr. Carroll, his expert, gave after the lineup occurred. At that time, there was nobody trained to do a sequential lineup. Gary Wells, the expert on whom everybody seems to be relying here, has said in one of his articles, and I think it's the 1998 article that's frequently cited, Eyewitness Identification Procedures. They laid out four rules for conducting a lineup. And they specifically said in that, at the end of that article, and I urge you to take a look at it, specifically said they were not including sequential lineup, and they were not including videotaping at that point for a couple of reasons. One is that they said specifically that the four rules would take care of the vast majority of problems. It didn't matter whether it was sequential, it didn't matter whether it was simultaneous, but that those four rules would take care of those problems. The second thing was that he said that a bad sequential lineup would almost certainly be worse than a well-run simultaneous lineup following those rules. So the issue here is, I think the problem is that we don't have an adequate offer of proof on which Judge Fiedler could understand why he should admit this expert testimony. The third thing about this is that if we want to get into the merits of the lineup, this lineup, although it was simultaneous in form, was sequential in fact. Because the way this actually carried out, the way the recognition occurred of the of Mr. Schomburg in the course of this lineup occurred almost identically to the way a sequential lineup would have been run.
Explain that to the court.
Okay, I will explain that. Gary Wells has said that the purpose of a lineup is to create a recognition memory test. This is one of the issues that was raised in the offer of proof, the difference between relative judgment and recognition memory. And in fact, the expert in his test, in his report, raises a question about, at one point, why the, why, Ms. Barrett did not fill out her form immediately. And then he says recognition memory is instant memory, is an instant, recall. What happened here, and I think it can best be shown by looking at the lineup picture that appears in the reply brief, in the Mr. Giesen's reply brief. What you said, the testimony was, this is, these are the six people, and Mr. Schomburg is number five. The testimony about the way this occurred was that the participants in the lineup entered from a door on the left as you're facing the lineup. And they came through the door individually. Each of the two witnesses, the Mr. Ferguson, the security guard, and Ms. Barrett said essentially, as soon as he came through the door, I recognized him. Mr. Schomburg was the second person through that door. That, when a person, regardless of how they look on the stage, as soon as he came through the door, that was their recognition. That is memory, that is recognition memory, that is not relative judgment. They recognized him even before they saw the other four. And interestingly, under the standards for conducting sequential lineups, the first person, the first image shown to a witness is supposed to be a filler. It's not supposed to be the actual person who's suspected. So Mr. Schomburg was actually in a position where he would have been, at the very least, in a sequential lineup. The first person through that door was supposed to be a filler and would have been in a sequential lineup. So when he came through that door, what was triggered was not relative judgment, but recognition memory. And that's what the expert was going to talk about, recognition memory, but that's what we had. Now the
so you're saying that if there was error, it was harmless.
Pardon?
So you think if that's the if it was error, it's harmless.
That would be part of a harmless error argument. That in fact what occurred was in fact what the expert of necessity by his own report, by the studies that have been done, by the representations of Gary Wells and other researchers, this triggered recognition memory, which is exactly what a lineup, as Mr. Wells says, is all about.
Mr. Wren, I'd like to go back just for a moment to the standard of review. You appear to be arguing the Hampton test, that this is an exercise of discretion.
That's correct.
But I'm concerned about some of our cases and whether or not we have a conflict. I'm looking at St. George, at Dotson, Pulizzano, Robinson, Johnson, which talk about determinations of constitutional fact and de novo review. Which is it and which should it be?
I think in this instance, this is nothing more than this is really routine kind of testimony for which the exercise of discretion is the appropriate standard. I don't think it's a de novo review at all on this.
But aren't we talking about, if we're talking about the constitutional right to present a defense, are we talking about constitutional facts here?
I don't think we are in this case, because if there had been a complete presentation of an offer of proof, if there had been a sufficient foundation, our argument is there was not a sufficient foundation laid, and therefore if the proponent of the expert testimony has not made an adequate foundation, then you have not implicated the constitutional right to a defense. You might have implicated ineffective assistance of counsel, which was specifically forsworn here. There was no claim of ineffective assistance of counsel in this case. But if you don't lay an adequate foundation, I don't even think you get to the constitutional question of whether defense has been deprived.
Because the question regarding that that point of view, did the state object to the proffer of the offer of proof at the time?
I don't know that. I think the state thought that the expert was not the state opposed the introduction of the expert testimony.
Now that I understand, but did the state object to the nature of the offer of proof? In other words, did they say that at the time that the offer was inadequate?
I don't recall whether they said it in those specific words. I mean, I don't know that he said specifically it's not adequate. Certainly, I think that's what Judge Fiedler was saying, is that he did not believe it was adequate because he kept saying, please explain this to me. Please explain how this is different. And Mr. Cohen came back and referred to relative judgment and recognition memory and so on, but never, as I was reading the transcript, I was saying, and where is this going? I kept waiting for him to make the statements that I would have expected an expert to make to clear up the confusion. And I never read those statements, and I think that was what Judge Fiedler's difficulty was. He did not feel that the explanation here sufficiently differed. And that's why I think it's a foundational question and never gets to the question of whether there was a deprivation of a constitutional right to present a defense.
Let me see if I understand it. Your position is that the trial judge made no error in excluding this testimony because the foundation was not adequate. If the judge was right under the rules of evidence that this should be excluded, you don't have any issue of constitutional right to the defense because it's excluded under a proper, neutral form of rule of evidence.
That would be correct, yes. The proponent of the expert carries a burden.
Your position at this moment is not that an expert could not have been or should not have been allowed to testify, but that here they could not. He could not because there wasn't an adequate offer of proof.
That's correct. I'm not here to tell the court that eyewitness experts should be excluded.
Okay, then that's my next question, because this court took this case, and your state's asking us, and maybe appropriately so, to decide it on an evidentiary rule of offer of proof, right?
That's correct.
But a bigger issue looms on the horizon.
Right.
An undefined horizon, right?
Yes.
Okay. What is the state's position, if it has one, on the issue of the admissibility of properly qualified expert opinion about about eyewitness identification?
If it satisfies 90702, it would be admissible, like any other expert testimony would be, subject to, as Mr. Giesen said, things like cumulativeness and so on. In other words, I don't have any problem acknowledging that relative judgment and recognition memory are things that are not within the common knowledge of jurors or fact finders. It certainly was not in the common knowledge of Judge Fiedler at the time that this was offered. He may know it now, but he didn't know it then. The problem was that Attorney Cohen, in my reading of the transcript, did not adequately explain what the significance of that was in making sufficient links to explain how that would help the fact finder. He repeated a definition of it. He repeated some what I would consider buzzwords and tried to explain it. But Judge Fiedler, and I think we can all agree that Judge Fiedler is a very bright man, kept trying to figure out how that was different from the kinds of things that an expert would not talk about. And ultimately, that's what Judge Fiedler decided it on. That's how he exercised his discretion. He basically said, I don't see how this is any different from what you can deal with on cross-examination or closing argument. And I think that's where this case rests. I think it's important to decide this case narrowly without deciding broader issues.
What would the narrow opinion be? This is your chance to write an opinion.
Well, I think the narrow opinion would be that the foundation was not adequate and therefore it was not an erroneous exercise of discretion to exclude the evidence.
But then you wouldn't go on?
I don't think you need to go on to anything else. The court could, of course, say, you've taken into consideration the various things that have been offered, that the Department of Justice, these best practices and so on, and urge departments to adopt them, perhaps. But I think that would be, I don't want to call it gratuitous, but I don't think that's actually necessary because the Department of Justice, through training and standards, is already out there training people. We had training at the DA's conference for prosecutors. I know the Training and Standards Board will be taking up the training in these procedures, these recommended procedures, as an issue, I think, in its next quarterly meeting to incorporate in the basic training curriculum. So the steps are already being taken to do this. And then the issue will come back when we get into the courts, into the trials, on the question that arose of battle of experts and so on. But I think the difficulty in this is that I don't think it presents the issue, actually, that this court took it on. I think a fair reading of the transcript was Judge Fiedler simply didn't see that this was that there was a foundation here. I think an expert, if the expert had been called, as this court has recommended in Dodson, as the Court of Appeals has talked about in Milenkovic and more recently in State versus Brown, that where you have a situation similar to this, where there might be some uncertainty about whether the attorney can make an adequate representation, the best way to do it is to call the expert for the offer of proof and do it through a Q&A. Had the expert been there, I have no doubt that Judge Fiedler's, so we're back to this, or what does that mean, would have been answered by the expert in a way that would have satisfied Judge Fiedler's curiosity. And my suspicion is that had the expert answered those questions the way I think he probably would have, we would have had a different ruling here. But I think it's all foundation.
Counsel, if indeed proper foundation had been laid, And this follows up just your finishing comments. If indeed the proper foundation had been laid, would the exclusion of this testimony constitute a deprivation of the constitutional right to present a defense?
I don't. Not for all the questions, not for all the exclusions. I think it's important to look at exactly what was excluded.
Okay.
I think
the first area of exclusion.
Well, I think there were five opinions that the expert listed in his report. Judge Fiedler said, I'm not going to let the expert testify about any of those things. And I think those are properly excluded. I don't think that implicates at all, because I think that if you look down through those five reasons, they aren't the kinds of things. One of them was, well, there are inconsistencies. There's no reason for an expert to talk about inconsistencies in identifications. That's the kind of thing that we deal with through cross-examination and closing argument. On the question of
Mr. Rand, if I could, regarding the adequacy of the offer.
I think he's getting to it, because there may not be other opinions, but is there a constitutional violation of deprivation?
I think that because of the significance of the eyewitness identification here, not necessarily in other cases, and this is why I would disagree with the idea of presumptive admissibility. But in this case, I think had there been an adequate offer explaining relative judgment and recognition memory, that it would have been, that there would have been a violation at that point of the constitutional right to present a defense, because that would have been significant information that a fact finder would have found perhaps persuasive. Now, we've also raised the state bringing in its own expert to refute all that, but
does that mean, if I may, Justice Bob, does that mean then that if this court finds, after reviewing the record, that there is a sufficient offer of proof here, as measured against our case law, that then we should find, based on what you just indicated, on the facts of this case, a constitutional deprivation?
I think on the narrow issues that I noted, in this case, and again, I emphasize this case.
Where identity is the beginning and the end.
Right, and the information is significant to a decision, then yes. If there was an adequate foundation, and that's where I have the problem with what happened in this case, is that despite the repetition of the phrases relative judgment, despite the kind of explanation that Attorney Cohn tried to give, it wasn't making the link as to why this why an expert would have to testify about it. Relative judgment says, well, you're comparing one to another. You can ask an expert, you can ask a witness, if aren't you really just comparing one thing to another? Witness can say yes or no. But what the expert can say is that something along these lines. An expert could say, what witnesses don't understand is they don't realize that that's what they're doing. But that wasn't what was offered here.
Counsel, are you then giving up on your harmless error defense? In answer to Justice Bradley's question, should we assume you're now giving up on your harmless error defense if we don't agree with you and we conclude there was an adequate foundation?
Well, I'm not actually giving up on it. I think there's a, if you have concerns, I think I understand what the court's concerns are here, that maybe what we've got is something that's in between the deprivation of a constitutional defense and ineffective assistance of counsel, but doesn't quite fit discretionary reversal.
With teeth.
Yeah, right. The problem here, I think, is in a sense, it's not necessarily unique, but I think it's affected by the fact that this is such a new, this was at the time such a new area that there were experts who could testify about this, but the attorney couldn't necessarily explain it the way an expert would and satisfy Judge Fiedler. Because of the unique posture of this case as a trial to the court, one way of dealing with the problem here, this foundational problem, would be to say, in effect, vacate the Court of Appeals decision, remand this for, basically put it back in the post-conviction motion posture, remand it to the trial court for Judge Fiedler to hold another offer of proof proceeding with the expert, with this expert, not a new expert, but this expert, the one that they wanted to present, doing a full Q&A, and then let Judge Fiedler, because he was the fact finder, determine whether that would have affected his decision.
And counsel, that's where I want to stop you, because you've argued on numerous occasions now that an adequate offer of proof would include a Q&A, a question and answer session. As I read 90103, and I believe the cases support this, offers of proof can be made in a number of different ways.
Sure.
One is orally, one is submission in writing, one can be done by question and answer.
Correct.
And correct me if I'm wrong, while our case law may express a preference for question and answer, there's no requirement for question and answer. So what I want to just pin down is your argument. Are you arguing that the offer of proof in this case was inadequate because there was no question and answer, or are you arguing that it was inadequate because the attorney didn't explain it well enough?
I'm arguing that it was inadequate because the attorney didn't explain it well enough.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're talking the same thing here.
Right. No, I'm not arguing. There's no objection to an oral offer of proof. I mean, that's perfectly fine. It can save time. The problem here is that what we have is an area that was new to most everybody involved. In fact, at the trial, when Detective Morgan was asked by Attorney Cohen about the Madison Police Department adopting the technique of sequential lineup. This is basically a year after this lineup occurs. Even at that point, she says, we are going to get training in this. They hadn't even had training at that point. So when we're talking about this the offer proof, what the expert's going to testify about, this was a situation where if the attorney had understood it as well as the expert, the oral offer might have been successful. My position is it was not successful. If this court has concerns about that and doesn't see it fitting into any of these categories that we're used to, one way of addressing this would be to allow to remand it for an offer proof that would ramp it up to a Q&A, which would cure the inadequacy of the oral offer in this case.
Counselor, I asked you if you were giving up on your harmless error analysis, and I don't believe you answered my question. You began to tell me about this being a new area, but I need an answer.
I think it's harmless because of the way the lineup was actually conducted. But that in a sense, is, I mean, you would have to accept, and as I accept this, but I don't know whether you would, that the lineup, in fact, was functionally a sequential lineup that would satisfy the criteria that this expert was going to talk about. And therefore, the expert testimony, in a sense, would have been superfluous because he would have just been saying, yeah, this is recognition memory, which is exactly what he wanted to say was not the case here. So in that sense, I see it as harmless, and I think it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But it rests on an assumption or willingness to accept that this lineup, in fact, was something that it wasn't in form. And I don't know if this Court wants to go that far. So in that, if the Court doesn't accept my characterization of it, then I think you would find it not harmless. If you accept my characterization, then it would be harmless.
Okay. Thank you very much. Somewhere in your argument, I have a sense that underlying some of these themes is the concept that you're holding the trial court and the witnesses to a standard that was somewhat unknown to them at the time, the eyewitness identification and relative, et cetera. And then it may be unfair to hold everyone to a standard about eyewitness identification that we now know, 3 years later, 2 years later.
I don't know that I'm holding to a different standard.
A different state of knowledge.
Right.
Okay.
I think there's definitely a different state of knowledge. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I think that was part of Judge Fiedler's confusion. He wasn't familiar with any of this stuff. I mean, I was kind of familiar with it, so when I'm reading the transcript, I'm superimposing what I know on this. Judge Fiedler doesn't have anything to superimpose. He's literally approaching this as if, in a sense, he's a juror, and he's looking at this and thinking, well, this isn't helping me as a fact finder. I want to note sort of a chronological thing. The decision to seek a trial by the judge was made. They came into that hearing with two things in mind. One was the offer of proof on the expert, and the second was to waive a jury trial. So they had already decided, Mr. Schomburg had already decided he wanted to waive a jury trial before he knew what the ruling in this case was going to be. So I don't think that Judge Fiedler's decision should have any impact in terms of whether you decide he's entitled to a trial by jury or not, or whether that was an error.
Could I ask you, what is the most incriminating or compelling evidence that Mr. Schomburg committed this offense?
One of the things that was kind of compelling to me, I don't know what it was to Judge Fiedler, I think it was a combination of things. One was that the sketch that was done was instantly recognized by Mr. Schomburg's parole agent, which triggered the call to the police department that led to his arrest and then the lineup. The second thing I think that in light of this question about expert witness testimony, the second thing is the instantaneous character of the recognition by the witnesses of Mr. Schomburg in the lineup. I mean, that's recognition memory, not relative judgment at play. The third thing was that Mr. Ferguson, the security guard, testified that he saw Mr. Schomburg twice and in relatively well-lighted conditions, that he was fairly close to him, and that he concentrated on his face to make sure that he would remember it, to recognize it. There was also testimony about a sweater that Detective, I think it was Maureen Wall, who had arrested Schomburg in January, several months before this, had seen him wearing at the time, and that was retrieved from his mother's house, grandmother's or grandmother's house, and that Mr. Ferguson said he recognized from that night. And finally, I think what also played into it was that the judge simply did not believe the alibi witnesses. I mean, I think all of those things came together. I don't think there's one thing in particular, but I think the memory recognition, or the recognition memory that was triggered at the lineup, was an indication of how strong that was. In fact, one of the concerns I have about broad rulings in this area actually comes up as a result of the motion for the new trial, where they refer to this idea that they cite an article by Gary Wells saying that there's no correlation between certainty of identification and accuracy of identification. That was the one in 1998. Turns out in 2003, Mr. Wells writes another article where he says, well, more recent research has shown a real correlation between those two things. What we've got is an area where there's a lot of fluidity and flexibility going on. Making hard and fast rules about this, I think, it would be a danger. I think this case should be decided on a very narrow ground. And if this Court has concerns about whether there was a situation where we're dealing with a new kind of evidence, a new kind of knowledge, that this remand for the judge to conduct what could have been conducted better the first time, and then letting the judge decide whether that would have affected his decision, would get this back on a better track. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. Mr. Giesen, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. With respect to the inadequacy of the offer of proof, the record does not disclose that Judge Fiedler based his decision on that, nor, as I recall, was there an objection by the prosecutor that was insufficient. With respect to the standard of review question and counsel's response, it's our view this is an absolute de novo situation because there's a question of constitutional error. The constitutional issue of Mr. Schomburg's right to present a defense was raised by trial counsel in the motion in limine, citing the Sixth Amendment and Article I, Section 7. That's the motion in limine with respect to the admission of the expert.
Mr. Giesen, if I can ask you about that. Could we look at whether or not the expert was qualified under 90702 as a discretionary determination, and it only becomes a constitutional question if that expert is qualified?
I think there's an interplay between those. If a person, and under St. George, its first requirement is that 90702 must be met. There's no serious dispute in this case. Mr. Carroll was a 31-year Chicago police detective. While you can consider that in this case, certainly the criteria of 90702 are satisfied.
Well, he may be.
In terms of the standard, though, what I'm trying to pin you down is the standard. When we're evaluating the trial court's ruling on whether or not 90702, the expert qualifies under 90702, is that a discretionary determination? And then if the expert is qualified, we look at issues of constitutional fact, or is your argument that we're looking at even that initial determination as a constitutional fact?
As I understand this Court's previous decisions, those are independent determinations, but the Court has to weigh it differently, I believe, if the thumb of the Constitution is on the scale. The converse of that is there's no claim that this would not have been a proper exercise of discretion to have admitted this evidence. So this does satisfy, in our view, 90702. And the trial court must, as it failed to do and as the Court of Appeals failed to do under the mandate of St. George, consider the constitutional implications as well. With respect to the actual identification, we submit the record discloses that this was a classic issue of relative judgment. It was a process of comparison and elimination rather than of identification. The victim's own words were, he was the closest. 1, 3, and 5 were too big. 2 and 4 were too old. Her testimony, quote, he was the best of 6, and that's why she picked out number 5. And again, to quote her, although he very well could not have been the guy. So there were serious deficiencies. There was another issue of suggestibility. Both the victim and the security guard thought before they went in that the suspect was in the lineup. Mr. Ferguson, the security guard, said he'd been told so by a detective. And that's the sort of comment that DuBose noted is so suggestive that it greatly increases the chances of a misidentification.
Counsel,
please.
Mr. Giesen, your opposing counsel suggested the possibility of a hearing, another hearing before Judge Fiedler. What was your reaction to that?
Surprise, in the first instance. Secondly, concerns for double jeopardy problems. It seems to be an awkward procedure, especially where there was no inadequacy with the proffer, in our view. So it's, in my view, unprecedented to remand in those situations for this type of a finding.
If this court would determine that there is not a sufficient, well, I don't know how I was going to, I was going to try to say that if it was insufficient offer of proof, then there wouldn't be any reason to remand to the circuit court. I mean, I, too, wrote down my question was essentially the same as Justice Prosser's, because your opposing counsel indicated to remand to the circuit court to let them do what he should have done and then decide if it would affect his opinion. Your response to that is no.
No. With respect to the remand, my response is twofold. First, there was not objection to the adequacy of the proffer, either in the trial court or, as I view the State's brief, the St. George criteria were essentially conceded, with the possible exception of 90702. And we can argue about all these things, but in our view, the bottom line, the identification, the misidentification, was the real controversy, because the trial court, the finder of fact, did not have the benefit of expert evidence on very important concepts of relative judgment and suggestibility. The court precluded that relevant exculpatory testimony. The real controversy was not fully tried. We would respectfully request that this court vacate that conviction. Thank you.
Jason, 2 points. One, if this had been a jury trial, you couldn't send it back. If it were a jury trial, you couldn't send it back because the jury would have been gone. So the only reason you could possibly send it back is that it's a judge trial. And the question would then be whether you can make a distinction. Do you have anything to say about that?
There should not be a different standard applied because the fact finder was a trial court as opposed to a jury. There may be other practical considerations, but the legal standards, we believe, should be the same.
Second thing, neither you nor the State have discussed the polygraph issue. So I assume you want us to rely on the briefs, or have you withdrawn that as an issue?
We've not withdrawn. We would rest on the briefs on that particular point. We don't believe the court needs to get to that if it determines the real controversy was not fully tried.
Thank you, Mr. Giesen, and thank you, Mr. Wren, for coming this morning. And we're sorry that your initial appearance was disrupted, and we're sorry that your second and final appearance was disrupted. The court is adjourned for our September hearings, and we'll meet in the conference room at 10:45.